Forever Dog.
In the pines, in the pines, where the sun never shines, you'll shiver when the cold wind blows. There's a grave in the pine where the sun never shines. There's a grave that's shaded with the pine.
Now, before we dive in too deeply, I just wanted to make a quick note about terminology, and I wanted to thank Amy for letting me do this. It's my only bit of actual research that I did for this episode. There are a lot of different thoughts and opinions about how to refer to the indigenous peoples of America. The only opinion that should really matter in that conversation is the opinion of the indigenous people themselves, and so that's what I tried to narrow in on when I was looking into this. And it seems that the consensus is that any general term is going to be inherently misleading or oversimplified. The best term to use is the specific name of the tribe or group that you're actually talking about. So we will try to do that as much as possible in this episode. When we need a general term, we'll use Native American, while also acknowledging that that's not a perfect or specific term by any stretch of the imagination. And if you hear us use the word Indian in this episode, it's only done to mirror or quote the terminology of the time period that was used by white Americans. That's not a term that we think should continue to have any kind of active life or use in American culture or discourse. And that's what I wanted to say about terminology. Thank you.
True love lies in a narrow grave, in the pines where the sun never shines. She snow lies deep on my true lover's grave, in the pines, in the pines, in the pines.
Death is the mother of beauty. Hence from her alone shall come fulfillment to our dreams and our desires. That's Wallace Stevens. The poem is Sunday Morning. So relevant on two accounts, the first being this is Sunday, and the second account being it's Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day, everyone.
Happy Mother's Day. Death is the mother of beauty. Happy Mother's Day.
Okay.
I don't know about
that's
you.
For
but
all the mothers out there.
That's I read that poem to my mom today over the phone.
Oh, wow. How'd she take that?
Happy Mother's Day, and immediately hung up. I haven't heard back from her yet.
Okay.
So we'll see.
Wow, she just didn't even bother. She just moved right on with her day. Good for her.
Yeah. I mean, she's living her life. She's having a grand old time. She's down in the islands of South Georgia.
I mean, that's probably the greatest Mother's Day gift is a day without your children
is a quick annoying cryptic phone call. Oh, you're talking. Yeah. No, you're right.
Just in general.
Yeah. I thought you meant what I did.
Give moms a break.
I thought you meant what I did was the best Mother's Day present.
Oh no, not at all. The hanging up was the best part of that.
I'll give you one line of Wallace Stevens and then I'm out.
Yep.
She loves me.
Sure. What's next?
Did you call your mom today?
I did.
Yeah. How'd that go?
Good. She also is just hanging out with her husband today.
You'll notice Amy said husband, not father.
Well, yeah, he's not my father. It'd be weird. My father, who's not my father.
Which
but
is
yeah, my
how she refers to him.
Siblings and I bought her Rangers tickets.
That's really nice. I didn't know that until this moment.
Yep.
I mean, you could have bragged about that.
When?
I don't know.
Well, here we go. I'll brag about it now.
Yeah, there you go. With a bigger audience.
We all chipped in and got her Rangers
tickets.
That's
really nice. So. Rangers versus?
Well, I think maybe the Angels. Or no.
That's a good one this year.
Or maybe the Yankees.
Also a good one this year.
Yeah. So.
Wow. So either way.
I think one of those.
That's a really good game. Well.
Again, time away from us.
You're keeping score at home.
It's the best gift.
Amy has bested me once again, this time the competition being Mother's Day gifts.
I mean, hey, I wanted to send her an edible arrangement. That's always my go-to.
Edible arrangements.
Yeah, they're amazing. Have you heard of them?
I have. Yeah. Yeah, I have. And if not, I feel like I could put it together from the name.
I don't know. Yeah. They're pretty complex.
Look, you got your edible underwear. You got your edible arrangements.
It's what do you think an edible arrangement is? I'm curious.
You know, you have, you know how you have an arrangement
mm-hmm.
with somebody, like, oh, we have an arrangement.
Oh, like a deal? Okay.
Yeah.
Like an edible contract.
Yes. It's like, look, your father and I have an arrangement. So this would be an edible version of that.
Strange. Strange.
I didn't realize you were a fan of edible arrangements.
Well, I've never had one.
Okay.
I've only seen them from afar.
Through the window of the store, streaked with rain. Okay, yeah. I'm just picturing little orphan Amy on the outside of an edible arrangement store.
Abrupt transition into our subject of today. We're going to do things a little differently. And I feel like I say that every single episode. But today...
we do things a little bit differently.
Today, we are going to talk about a battle.
Oh.
Where many deaths occurred.
Oh, my goodness.
It is famously known as the Battle of Antelope Hills.
The Battle of Antelope Hills.
It took place on May 12th in 1858.
And to give a little context here, I know nothing about this battle.
Right. It's famous only to people who have studied the history of, like, the Indian Wars
okay.
in the American okay. West.
Just to give the listener a little context, Amy has been assiduously researching this week the topic that she's about to discuss. And I remember we gave a little disclaimer at some point in an earlier episode that we're not historians or journalists, we're storytellers, blah, blah, blah. But for this week, I think I can say that Amy is really, I mean, she has done her research.
I took a deep dive.
She took a deep dive.
Into the American West.
She went to the public library and checked out books on this.
One book.
So, okay, all right. One book, let the record show. But I just want you to know that she,
but
that,
a good
that
book.
Amy really put in her work this week. This was not just a, you know, read Wikipedia and then a couple extra online articles. This was a...
Well, I never do that.
Okay, all right. I'm showing my cards here.
Brett has no idea the amount of research I put into
and I just
every
revealed how much research I do on my episodes. So, but let it be sure that Amy went to the public library, checked out books, read the entire book, in addition to her normal. And we might as well say, what's the name of this book? I know you probably were going to say it later, but...
It is called Empire of the Summer Moon, and it is by a guy with the last name Gwyn, Gwyn.
Okay.
S.C. Gwyn. I think he's a professor who lives in Oklahoma.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to give the reader a seal of approval on this episode from a research standpoint.
It's pretty good. Yeah, it's a pretty good book. I mean, this was one of many options I had, and this was just the one I ended up going with. I did a lot of research online and was just finding information that seemed sketchy
yeah.
or untrue or yeah. unverifiable, which is why I chose to do this book instead. And I'm glad I did, because if I had stuck to some of the articles I read, I think I would have just given you guys a whole bunch of baloney.
Well, as you were saying to me yesterday, when it comes to things like the Indian Wars, the history of Texas, of states, there's probably a lot of misinformation due to misplaced pride in one's state or one's heritage, or refusal to acknowledge atrocities that are associated with your nationality or your state.
Exactly.
So
and it's a very one-sided
on,
right. It's a very one-sided you know. History too, because yeah. even I mean the person who wrote this book is a white man
yeah.
from Texas and Oklahoma, and all of the sources, even if he has a sympathetic view of the Comanches and
yeah.
a more like as objective as he can be outlook, you know, all the sources he uses, all the original sources, the letters and things like that, the articles are all from white people.
Right. Right.
We have no written texts from the Comanches.
So you can never fully escape the
subjectivity
white American
of,
point of view on this.
Right.
It's hard to sort of get objective outside of that. Interesting. Well, that's right. Good to know as a starting point.
But that's kind of why I try to stick to just the facts.
Yeah.
And then you and I can maybe give our opinions where we feel we want to. But the story itself is very interesting. So
the Battle of Antelope Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And it took place on what day?
May 12th, 1858.
So that was yesterday, calendar date yesterday.
I guess so, yeah.
So as you know, we always pick a death that occurred on the previous calendar week. So in this case, it was very recent, yesterday.
Just yesterday. And again, I'm picking the same like span of 100 years I always pick. But this is a part of the world that we have not entered.
That's right.
As of yet in this podcast.
I'm very excited for this.
And
I know nothing.
It is crazy.
Listener, I'm on your side unless you are an expert in the Indian Wars or the Battle of Antelope Hill. If you are not, I'm in the same boat with you. I'm very excited to learn more about this and just chip in as needed.
Ask questions and hopefully I can provide some answers. I think the biggest thing is, you know, there's not a whole lot written about the battle. I can definitely give the story of what happened and who died, and specifically the Comanche chief who was killed famously at this battle. And we'll talk about all that, but I'm going to spend a lot of time giving context.
Okay.
Because the context is very important to know sort of how they got to this point and what this battle created moving forward.
Interesting.
For the
Well, let's get in our
frontier.
In our tombstone-shaped time machine.
All right,
two very different sounds. That was one door making both a old Victorian creaking sound and a sci-fi
futuristic
sound. Okay. It exploded in midair.
All right. Well, I guess we just
dead.
Have to stay here.
And now
talk
that we're
about
dead,
it.
We can talk about the fellow dead. That's the premise of that.
Yes. That's what we had planned
Noise.
All along.
Okay. All right.
So the Battle of Antelope Hills was between the Comanche tribe of the American West and essentially the Texas Rangers. And the Texas Rangers had alongside them sort of quote-unquote friendly reservation
okay.
Native Americans who had sided with them.
And the Texas Rangers, not the baseball team that you bought your mom tickets to.
No, not them at all.
Who were the Texas Rangers?
So the Texas Rangers were unofficially formed in the 1820s, around 1823, and then officially in 1835. And essentially, they were just a group of men who maybe had some military experience, but not much, and basically just did what the federal government refused to do,
which was
track the Comanches down, because it was mainly the Comanches who were proving to be a difficult tribe of Native Americans to exterminate to be just plain spoken about it. The federal government had tried and failed to make peace treaties, and, you know, they promised Native Americans things that they would never be able to deliver. And so these peace treaties were broken again and again, created, broken.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the Comanches, who were a very warlike tribe and had always been, even before the white settlers, were doing these raids on these towns that were popping up in Texas on their land, Comanche land.
Yeah.
So eventually this group of men got together, and they're famous for fighting the Comanches kind of on their terms, because what made the Comanches so hard to beat in battle was, first of all, they were mounted. So unlike the Native Americans on the East Coast, the Comanches had horses that they had been using at least 100 years in dealing with the Spanish conquistadors and the Mexicans who came up from the south.
This is why the Normans were able to defeat the Anglo-Saxons at the Battle of Hastings. Same thing.
Well,
they came over from France. They were mounted, and the Anglo-Saxons were just on foot with spears and rocks and things like that, and made quick work of them. So
It's a huge advantage. And the white settlers had horses too, but they were not well versed at all in fighting while mounted, which is what the Comanches were so great at, is that they could fight while riding their horses. And they were just amazing
so
marksmen.
So the Texas Rangers, there was a lot of, whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
A lot of that.
Yeah, like you would ride up to the battle and dismount and then fight on foot.
Right.
Which was very typical of that time.
Right.
But the Comanches were very different. And so they were just, I mean, winning.
And so all of these battles that the Texas Rangers initiated were, you were saying, were endorsed by the federal government?
They
were
no, not at all.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
So the federal, and that's what marked one of the changes that occurred after this sort of quote unquote success of this battle in the Texas Rangers, the Battle of the Antelope Hills. Before, these men were not allowed to ride into Native American territory. They were not allowed to go on the offense. They were not allowed to attack villages, but these rules were very passively kept up, and there was no one really to enforce them. So they broke a lot of laws by doing this, but that's exactly what they did, is they, instead of just acting in defense, which was what made it so difficult to keep these raids at bay, these Comanche raids at bay, they decided to go on the offense and track them down.
And they're, even though if it wasn't endorsed by the federal government, they're clearly doing things that serve the ultimate goals of the federal government. So it's hard to believe that there maybe wasn't some kind of tacit support of it. Like, we can't officially allow this, but it's going to get us what we want ultimately, which is eradication of Native American populations.
Right. You basically had two types of white men. One was like the Sam Houstons of the bunch, who were quote unquote diplomatic and signed all these peace treaties, but were completely inept at keeping them and completely inept at enforcing them.
Mm-hmm.
So you had that type of white guy who was maybe sort of well-intentioned on paper, but could not,
when push comes to shove,
have anything substantial change in the dynamics between Native Americans and white settlers.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had this other type of white man who was just like one of the other presidents of the Republic of Texas before Texas was annexed into the U.S., this other guy named Mirabeau Lamar.
Mirabeau Lamar. And Sam Houston was the first president of the Republic of Texas.
And Lamar, I think, came after him,
if
I remember correctly. But Lamar was just like extermination, and just said it. He was like the Trump of his era, where he just like says it boldly and outwardly and openly and just has no shame.
Mm-hmm.
But much like Trump, he's saying what a lot of people are already thinking.
Right.
So he gets a lot of support.
He voices the dark thoughts that are already there.
Yeah.
And thereby legitimizes them and makes them policy.
Right. And Sam Houston tried to be as diplomatic as possible and had and sort of favored the Native Americans on a lot of things. And in theory, did not want to take their land, especially because the land that the Comanche lived on were not, it was very difficult land to survive in. I mean, this is like West Texas, Oklahoma, you know, this is like the plains, which had a lot of buffalo, which is why the Comanches, you know, were there.
Mm-hmm.
But really, Sam Houston wanted to just have a border and enforce that border, and just was completely unable to. So the Battle of Antelope Hills occurred in 1858, in the middle of all of this.
Okay.
The Texas Rangers had been around for almost 30 years at this point. They had some successes. There was a time where the Texas Rangers are really famous, but there was really only maybe 5 years where they were really successful in fighting the Comanches. And it was the time during a guy named Jack Hayes led them and taught them how to fight like the Comanches, how to go into battle mounted, how to sneak up on them and use guns at close range. And he was the same guy who introduced the six shooter, the five shooter first, and then the six shooter into the like American West frontier, and was very much like lived off the land and traveled in very small groups and hid in the hills and fought usually by surprising a village and also really by just killing everyone, mm-hmm. men, women, and children, and going after the Comanches versus like waiting to be attacked and then acting in self-defense. Jack Hayes was the first Texas Ranger to implement all that. And it's really sort of vile. And these guys in the East anyways had kind of a bad reputation too for just being like ungentlemanly and kind of gross and kind of uncivilized. But they were at the very least successful, you know, to some degree. But the thing is, they disbanded after a few years and Jack Hayes went off to California and made his wealth in like real estate in Oakland. He was like one of the first sheriffs of like San Francisco County. And the Texas Rangers just kind of disbanded for a while. And other than those few years, they were pretty unsuccessful. Like, just no one knew how to beat the Comanches. They were so good. They had such a good military and such a good cavalry. And they were nomadic. So they weren't always sitting in one place.
Yeah.
Which is different than the East, the Eastern tribes who were hunter-gatherers and who were easy to find. So in 1858, the Rangers, having been disbanded and ineffective since the probably 10 or 15 years, since Hayes left, Jack Hayes left, they decide to get together and form a new group of men and under this guy whose nickname was Rip Ford.
Okay.
He was named Rip Ford because anytime he sent letters home to soldiers' families, he would put like rest in peace or RIP next to the names. So he got this like nickname, Rip Ford.
So he's writing so many of these letters that he becomes synonymous with it.
He insisted on like putting RIP next to all the dead's names. He used to work under Jack Hayes, like the original like super successful Texas Ranger. So he knew the ways to beat the Comanches. He had seen success in that area. So they hired him. And this is after the annexing of the Republic of Texas. So Texas had been a state since 1836. That's when the Alamo happened. So since 1836, Texas had been a state. But like we had mentioned earlier, the federal government was just really inept at keeping the warring and the battles against these like American West Plains, they were called Plains Indians, at bay. So finally the Texas Rangers, they regroup, they form a new, they get about 100 men and they get about 113 reservation Native Americans who agree to scout and track the Comanches and who were really good at it. And without them, the Texas Rangers probably would have never been able to find the Comanches.
Were they, these scouts themselves, Comanches? What tribe were they?
No, they were mostly Tonkawas.
Okay.
And this was a tribe that the Comanches just nearly exterminated.
Okay.
So, I mean, the Comanches were the strongest, most warlike Native American tribe in the entire area and had just like, they basically demolished the Apaches. They nearly exterminated the Tonkawas and they had been warring with all these different tribes for hundreds of years at this point.
So the Tonkawas' incentive in assisting the Americans, the Texas Rangers, is mostly a hatred of the Comanches?
A lot of it, yeah. Okay. A lot of it, yeah. And some of it was also probably striking deals with them. And at the time, Oklahoma was still technically reservation land where Indians were supposed to be able to live in peace.
Yeah.
And that was going horribly, mostly because the Texas Rangers, in this example, the Texas Rangers just ride across the Red River up north into Oklahoma, into reservation area, and basically just kill anyone they meet. So that's just another example of the federal government failing to live up to their promises to the Native Americans. But the Tonkawas, I'm sure, had something in it for them financially. But at the same time, yeah, they had a real hatred for the Comanches. So Rip Ford, with his band of a couple hundred people, ride into Oklahoma, you know, travel for days, and the trackers, the scouts is what they were called, or the spies, the Tonkawa Indians, find tracks of, you know, Comanches, like horse, you know, whatever. And they come upon this small group of Comanche warriors. I think it was just like four or five of them, and kill almost all of them. One or two gets away and rides back, and the Tonkawas follow those guys to this much bigger Comanche village of maybe about like, I mean, the numbers are always like sketchy at best, but maybe about like 1,000 people. So this was like more than just warriors. This was women, children. They had set up their teepees. This was about as close to a home or a village as the Comanches got. And they would not stay there long because, again, they were nomadic, but they set up shop there for a little while. So Ford sends the Tonkawa scouts in first, and the Comanches are meant to assume that they're only dealing with like a band of Tonkawa warriors. Ford rides in with his team and basically kills a lot of the warriors.
Oh my goodness.
But the main person that they're able to kill is the Comanche chief, and his name is, let me see if I can get this right, Pobishikwaso.
Okay.
I might be pronouncing that wrong, but Pobishikwaso, he was also known as Iron Jacket.
Okay.
Because he wore this ancient Spanish, like, iron mail.
Yeah.
Which is just, you know, just like armor. And it protected him from arrows, and it protected him from like light ammunition.
Where would that have come from?
The conquistadors. They had a lot of, yeah. I mean, for the past, what, couple hundred years, they had been fighting the Mexicans and then eventually trading with the Mexicans and established kind of like an understanding, which we'll get into a little bit later. But that's probably where he got it from. And it was probably something hundreds of years.
With the Mexicans, and then from there, the Comanches would have traded with the Mexicans?
Yeah, so before the white settlers are even close to being anywhere near that area,
there's more of like fluid interchange of these different cultures.
Right, the Spanish conquistadors came up through Mexico hundreds of years earlier and were able to, I mean, they basically took out the Aztecs, I think the Incas, like all those tribes of like Latin America, and just kept moving up north.
Right.
And then they get to what is now like the Mexican U.S. border, and the land is a lot, very difficult to track anything, very flat, dry, difficult place to live and survive, a place that they weren't used to at all. And the Comanches were just so strong and so good, like militaristically. And they fought the Spanish conquistadors. Just fought them back, which is part of the reason why they never were able to move any further north.
So, and they might have taken off of somebody that they killed then, the Iron Jacket.
Probably one of his ancestors did.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is
something that was probably handed down
from
like a father to a son for a few generations.
Forged probably in Europe, I would assume, before the conquistadors came over. An iron breastplate or kind of mail, you said. Forged in Europe, brought over here, and then ends up in the hands of the Comanches after a successful battle against Spanish conquistadors.
Yep. Ends up in the hands of one of Iron Jacket's, you know, forefathers, and is probably just passed down from generation to generation.
I mean, it must have been wild for 19th century Americans to see that, because I assume at this point they have... I mean, at that point, that's such an old time period for them. I mean, it's like that their time period is to us, and we see, you know, sketched images of what people looked like in the 19th century or something. I'm sure they had sketched images of conquistadors and knights and things from the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. So, I don't know. It just feels like it'd be like if you encountered somebody in battle today. And they were, you know, dressed like George Washington or something, right? It's just such an anachronism to come across that. It must have been very surreal.
I mean, this is like the ultimate of culture clashes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because like the Comanche tribes, like the Native Americans of the plains were much more, I guess, behind in terms of what we consider like a part of civilization or culture. They had no art. They had no They didn't weave baskets. They didn't do anything really creatively. It was just survival for them, which was much different than the like Native American tribes of the East Coast, who were hunter-gatherers, much further along in terms of like being quote-unquote civilized.
Right. And again, a lot of that probably goes back to the geography. The idea that you're living in a harsher terrain, the Comanches are living in a harsher terrain, living in a part of the country that demands that kind of mentality maybe at that time.
Maybe, yeah. And I don't know if they were nomadic out of choice or necessity. I mean, certainly it worked to their advantage once the white settlers showed up and the conquistadors and the French that they were nomadic. But why they never settled down somewhere. I mean, it could just be that it was so much a part of their culture to war. And they were so good at it. And for them, there was just never a reason to stop. They had quelled so many tribes around them successfully.
Yeah.
It was something they took great pride in.
Yeah. I mean, you see that throughout history. I mean, you know, whether it be the Spartans or the Mongols or whoever, but just cultures or civilizations that have war as their centerpiece, as their defining element, and everything else sort of arranges itself around that central premise.
Right. And they were even more fascinating because the Comanches didn't have any type of social structure. I mean, there was very much like the men had this job. The men went and hunted and killed buffalo, and the women did literally everything else.
Yeah.
But other than that, there was no, like, they had a civil chief or a peace chief, and they had a war chief. But really, that is not how, like, white people have come to understand them. It's not like one guy ruled over X amount of people, like a king. He just was really, if you were a war chief, it just meant you were really good at fighting in battle. And you were good at leading an army. It was almost like being a general or something.
And then the peace chief would...
The peace chief had sort of more magic, is what... Like, they didn't believe in a god. They didn't believe in anything like that. But they did believe that everything around them had powers.
Shamanic sort of properties.
Yeah. And so he was able... Sometimes he was also a medicine man. But for the most part, he would tell them, like, where to go next. Like, oh, this is where the buffalo are. We need to go here. This is where a white settlement is. We need to go here. And, like, on and on. But neither of them had, like, immeasurable power.
Supreme authority or
total authority. Right, and there were stories, too, of they would take captives of anyone. Other tribes, like the Mexicans, the French, the white, like, English settlers. They would take captives, and basically these captives were, depending on the age, if you're a man, you're getting killed, like, tortured and killed immediately. If you're a young child, sometimes if you're too young, they kill you because they don't want to, it's like too much of a pain to rear you. But if you're a child of like 8 or 9, 7, 8, 9, they'll bring you into the tribe and you will literally become like family to them. And that's what happened to this woman, Cynthia Ann Parker. She was kidnapped in the 1830s and she was at 9 years old. So she was able to become one of their family members and ended up marrying like a war chief, Peta Nakona.
And she would have been part of a Texas settlement or an Oklahoma settlement?
Her family settled in Texas just south of Dallas. But this was still technically Mexican territory. Well, I mean, it was still Comanche territory, but the Mexicans had tried and failed to take that land from the Comanches. And so the Mexicans, and I'm paraphrasing this so much, but the Mexicans basically told like people in Louisiana and kind of that area, like, you guys can come out here and have this land without informing them, like, the Comanches will probably raid and, like, slaughter your family. Like, you can have this. Like, basically, the Mexicans were like, we give up.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to trade with the Comanches. We're going to trade horses. We're going to have, like, a diplomatic relationship as much as we can, but we're done fighting them.
Right. And therefore, we're going to open this up for American immigration.
Right. So this is, like, 1933. The Parker family comes over and settles, like, just south of what is now Dallas, in very much Comanche territory. And by the way, Comanche territory is called Comancheria, So anytime it's like Comanchery, it's like you are in Comanche territory. Yeah. They settle there.
And by the way, I just want to say real quick, it's just as you're talking, it is insane to me the way certain people debate immigration policy now in America as though none of this ever happened.
Yeah.
Right? As though this land hasn't passed through multiple ownerships of different nations or peoples, or as though it wasn't, you know, fluid and in flux throughout most of its history.
Oh yeah.
It's and as though Americans weren't the original immigrants to that.
Yeah. You know, we act like we've had this land for like thousands of years.
Yeah, it's just amazing that like and I'm not even saying like whatever your final thought is. I'm just saying it's regardless of where you stand on immigration policy, it's insane that we talk about it without this context.
Well, and we just have no idea. Like I learned history in Texas. I was raised in Texas. And I knew about none of this.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's also just like what our teachers and like the adults like choose to teach us.
Well, it's also
history was so much propaganda when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Especially going to like a Christian academy. Like I was like, oh, I had no idea about any of this. Yeah. None of it whatsoever. Yeah. I knew the name Sam Houston because he has a huge statue in Texas. Yeah. And we're all like, Sam Houston's our guy. But like the failure of the Republic of Texas, all the warring that happened between the Mexicans who like came from the Spanish conquistadors and the French moving in from Louisiana and the English settlers coming in and like all these Native American tribes like fighting to keep the land that they've had for hundreds of years. I'm like, you know, it happened in like theory, but you don't know any details.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's the living legacy of Manifest Destiny is there's a different and again, like, you know, it seems like there's always been people fighting over the land that you're talking about. There's always been different groups of people at war over the ownership of that land. But to me, what separates the white settlers and American expansion is this secondary theoretical concept of manifest destiny. This idea that like this isn't just ours if we can get it. This is destined to be ours. It is our like birthright. Our kind of spiritual birthright.
So strange considering it's land that we knew nothing. Like it's not like Israel coming back to land that they
Well, there's at least a historical
supposedly
precedent
there.
There's a historical narrative, but no,
we
this
know
is,
nothing about this.
Right?
Place.
Yeah, and so the idea that we're not just one of several groups that are negotiating or fighting over its ownership, we are taking what has always been ours. It's such an insane perversion of just time and history and everything into this one sort of single idea of entitlement, and you know,
it's pretty crazy. And and Sam Houston, who like wanted so badly, who I guess based on how he's described, like didn't believe in manifest destiny, at least to the degree that like he didn't believe in just taking over all of like Native Americans like Comanche territory and etc. He wanted to live with them and was fine having borders. But there were just white settlers could not abide these treaties and these borders. And they would constantly, these families like the Parkers would just move in and set up shop. And then a lot of them early on, like the Parkers, would just get really brutally murdered.
Yeah.
And Cynthia Ann Parker's family moves into what is now Texas around 1833. She gets kidnapped in 1836. But she becomes a member of the Comanche family, ends up marrying and having children, and like by all accounts loved her life and couldn't even speak English when they later
that was gonna be my one question was language barrier. Was how I mean you think about how long it takes to acquire a language, particularly. Well, she's 9. I guess maybe her acquisition skills would be a little higher, so she could probably acquire it a little more easily.
She learned it. Yeah, she learned it to the point where
she forgot
her own.
I mean, the way you're describing this culture, they don't have schools. I don't imagine if they're nomadic.
They don't have schools, but I don't know. I don't know how like extensive the language was at the same time. Like they didn't have words for a lot of things. I mean, their life was so simple.
They had an efficient language that matched the realities of their life.
Right. Yeah. And but the thing that they, what I read was they had a vast language for describing horses. Like they loved horses. Right. And they were, that was like their main source of wealth too. They survived as far as like food wise off of the buffalo of the land, which were vast and very numerous. But financially and diplomatically, they survived off horses, like stealing or buying or trading or breeding. They're one of the few Native American tribes who were able to breed horses, and it made them really wealthy.
It's the old thing about Eskimos having 40 words for snow.
Right. It's just out of necessity.
It's actually not true, but it's, well, it's really interesting because it kind of gets at the issue of what language is, which is the only reason that people who are not, you know, I mean, it's a very like outsider perspective. But the only reason people think that Eskimos have 40 words for snow is because they don't understand snow very well. And so like the 40 words are for 40 unique, different things, like different types of snow or manifestations of snow or like something that is pre-snow or post-snow, or so they just know, you know, that that thing very well, and so they need more words because there's more, they have a deeper knowledge of it,
right?
And so for us it seems like 40 words for snow, but it's just because we don't know anything about snow,
right?
So I would assume the same thing for horses, that it's you know, they had such a deep knowledge of it that you need more linguistic resources
exactly
to describe it all,
right? And in the buffalo, I mean, they made their clothing out of buffalo. They made their teepees out of buffalo. Obviously, that was their main food source, because they were not agriculturers. Like, they did not grow things for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
They made their weapons out of different parts of the buffalo, like the bows and arrows and things. Like, it was horse and it was buffalo.
Mm.
And that is how they survived. So anyways, I'm guessing maybe the language for her, and she's at that age where her brain is still
she's
absorbing so
easier,
much, is that she probably acquired it a lot easier.
Yeah, I think that answers it. Yeah.
But in her later years, when she was recaptured by the Texas Rangers and brought back to like the white settlements, she did not know English. And she was actually so depressed that they killed her husband in the process. And took her away from her children and her family. She eventually just starved herself to death.
Oh my God.
Or like developed pneumonia from starvation and just like weakened immune system and died.
And meanwhile, her second captors assumed that they were saving her.
Yeah. When they had tried to capture her previously too, and she would refuse to go. So it's like they knew damn well that she wanted to stay with like the Comanche tribe she was living with, the band that she was living with. And they were just like, they couldn't understand a white woman. There's like, you know, this bizarre protection of like white women in like a white man's mind. And like that carries through to like, you know, even like the 1950s and stuff with like lynching black men for like brushing against a white woman or like like getting too close to her, making her uncomfortable. Like there's this bizarre notion that they have to, like, white women have to be saved from everyone.
Right.
And that was kind of true here. Like, she adamantly told them, I don't want to go back, two or three times. Like, I have no interest in it. And they went and got her and killed her family and took her back anyways.
The premise of the great movie The Searchers directed by John Ford, probably one of the one of my favorite westerns.
Oh really?
But yeah, I mean it's you know, widely recognized as one of the best westerns. Not like
I discovered
it. I remember though being depicted as though there's something sort of futile and unsatisfiable about John Wayne's urge to get her back. And I felt there some sort of theme that was interesting, that this sort of like the white desire to control and take, and this white sense of entitlement, there is something sort of lost at the center of that ideology. There
I mean,
is a
I
hole
think
at
with,
the center of it. And
in the real story, I think it was just, it boggled people's minds that any white person would choose like the Comanche way of life over the more, quote, civilized, like white settlements. But I mean, there were a lot of wonderful things about the Comanche way of life. and like the Plains Native Americans, they were living on one of the most lush lands in terms of buffalo,
mm-hmm.
and food was just, had never been easier. And they didn't have, they were just able to survive and thrive because they were so good at fighting off other places and keeping this land protected. And this happened to be the land where all the food was. Even though it was very hard work and a very hard life, especially for women, because they did everything from like skinning the buffalo
yeah.
to like drying the meat to creating the food to taking care of the kids to doing literally everything
yeah.
while the men basically hunted and killed and then just like went on raids and partied.
Yeah.
Going on a raid was like a huge party for them. It was.
Oh, wow.
Very violent. Like they were also one of the absolutely most violent yeah. tribes of the area. Their killing you was not just, they didn't just kill you to kill you. They loved to torture people and they loved, it was like a part of their ritual to make you suffer as long as possible. The Tonkawas, though, who were scouts for the Texas Rangers, were like the most cannibalistic of this,
really?
Of this area. So it was very common among many different tribes to, that was just how they warred. That was just how they fought, is it was very violent, very bloody,
mm-hmm.
lot of torture, very sort of vicious. And the white settlers were sort of like appalled by it and thought of it as so uncivilized. But really, I mean, it's pretty hypocritical because how quickly did it take like the Texas Rangers to start doing the exact same stuff
right.
to them?
Right.
And the whole premise is like, you're on their land.
Right. This wasn't, they weren't,
you they encroached were doing raid- upon them.
Right.
And yeah. And I mean, a lot of the white settlers paid for it. But going back to this battle, this was one of the big turning points in favor of the white settlers
mm-hmm.
and what became big disadvantages to the Comanche tribe. Is these Texas Rangers started fighting on their terms, basically, and killing everything and everyone in sight. And there was just no, they had lost all notions of like honor, which is what the federal government was like sort of passively trying to claim, you know, is that we're honorable. Like we have to do this a certain way, but mm-hmm. no follow through with that whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this battle, Iron Jacket is, Ford's group, the scouts find these tracks. They come upon this Comanche village. Ford sends the Tonkawas in to fight first. And then the Rangers surprise the Comanches by like coming in right after them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Comanches just didn't even realize they were there, apparently. Mm-hmm. And they just ended up killing as many people as they could. And mm-hmm. what happened with Iron Jacket is that he's the war chief. So he rides out in this very like ritualistic way. Rides out on his horse and like performs his magic, because the like iron Spanish mail that he wore
yeah.
protected him from like most arrows and like light caliber bullets, which mm-hmm. before the late 1850s, the white settlers used the long rifle, the Kentucky
right.
rifle, which is basically
right.
like a 22.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't hit it, you know, this male protected him from that. But in this battle, this was one of the first battles where they used like the Mississippi rifle, which is I think like a 30 something caliber.
Okay.
A lot stronger.
Yeah.
And this was one of the first battles where they used six shooters.
Oh wow.
Which like a 44. Mm. Like what's his name?
I had no idea you know this much about guns.
Well, I don't. I just learned it learning about
learned
all
it
this.
As part of this research?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought your Texas was showing there for
no.
a second.
Although I did own a gun at one point. My boyfriend,
true story.
My ex-boyfriend bought me one.
Ex-boyfriend
and then took
bought
it back when we broke up.
Like
I had
Steve
what did I
a
have?
Jerk.
I had a .32 Smith & Wesson, I think. I mean, it's kind of a cool gun, but
you ever
I had
to pull
no
it on anybody?
Use. No, except him.
As he was trying
almost
to take it back.
Pulled it on him one time. No, so they just had a lot stronger weapons.
Yes.
And so
I'm Amy's most beta male partner, by the way.
Well, that's why we work.
Yes.
So Iron Jacket, you know, rides out, performs his magic, which involves like walking his horse around in circles and like saying this, not prayer, but this song really. And then blowing air out, because he was known to like move bullets and arrows away from their targets by blowing on them. Wow. That was his magic that he had. And he was seen as like invincible by both sides, by the Rangers and the white settlers and other Native American tribes and his own Comanche band.
So there was, even if there wasn't art per se, there was definitely a mythology then.
There was, they believed in magic. Okay. Like I said earlier, like everything had, the reason you would eat someone after war is that you gain their powers and different things like that.
Okay.
And you would accrue things hoping to get the power from it. So there was magic that
there's
they believed in.
A central mythology of magic, and then these anecdotes would spring off of that around specific people or specific.
Right. And okay. And Iron Jacket was a war chief and a medicine man too.
Okay.
So he probably had more quote unquote powers than like other warriors might have. He had more ability.
So I wonder how does he gain the reputation for being able to blow bullets away?
Well, because this male protected him from light bullets and from arrows.
Okay.
So he would go out in the most dangerous moments and people would shoot at him and they would bounce right off.
And then
he would
tell people that it was because he was blowing them away.
Yeah.
As opposed to
that he could blow arrows away.
Interesting. And then some poor sucker goes out and tries to try it next battle, just runs out to the front lines.
Well, no, I think it was just Iron Jacket's. That was just Iron Jacket's magic. But this is the day he dies, unfortunately. This is the end of Iron Jacket's life.
Victim of technology.
They just had stronger ammunition, yeah, and they shot him down. And the Comanches were very ritualistic and very kind of predictable in the sense that the Rangers figured out that if you kill their chief, the battle's basically over. Mm-hmm. Like, they will not keep fighting.
I said it again, Battle of Hastings. This is like Battle of Hastings, where the Normans defeated the Anglo-Saxons and took control of England. Same exact thing. Edwin the Confessor, I believe, was the Anglo-Saxon king, and he caught an arrow in the eye and died. And that was sort of the beginning of the end. I mean, in addition, they had horses and everything else, but... You know, very similar template here. And I'm sure there are many other examples, too.
And that was very true for the Comanches. And a lot of battles the Rangers would win were just because they were able to kill the chief.
Right.
So that's exactly what happened here, is that Iron Jacket gets shot down and his horse gets shot down. And his Comanche warriors, they put up a fight, but it's mostly out of self-defense. And quickly, they just start running. And that was another Comanche thing, is the second you think you're going to lose like a certain amount of men, you run. So they run into the hills and kind of wooded area, and the Rangers just track them down and kill as many as possible. They end up killing like 76 men, which for these battles is
a
ton of people. These were battles where like maybe 10 people would die.
Yeah.
And the Rangers on their end, they only lost maybe like 2 Rangers, and they don't keep count of how many Tonkawas they lost. So I don't know how many they lost there, but they only lost 2 Rangers, and 76 Comanche men, women, and children died, and they took many more prisoner.
The women and children weren't in the battle, though. They were tracked down.
No, but presumably the Comanche warriors are fighting like man-to-man combat in this like wooded area against the Rangers to give time for the women and children to run.
Gotcha.
So it was very valiant, very heroic.
Iron Jacket's already dead.
Iron Jacket's dead. And the Rangers are kind of picking off the Comanche warriors as many as they could. But here's one of the most interesting things about this battle. So the Comanches, it's a huge tribe. Mm-hmm. It's like basically an empire at this point. Mm. They're so vast. They're so powerful. There's 5 different main bands of Comanches. And they are the, I'm going to probably butcher the pronunciation, the Yamparica, the Katsoteka, the Pinateka, the Nakoni, and the Kahati. Those were the 5 different bands. And they actually don't know, or I found unverifiable guesses, basically, at which band Iron Jacket was actually chief of.
Okay, interesting.
Could have been the Pinateka who had the most interaction with white settlers. It could have been one of the lesser known Kahatis who like shunned contact with the Anglo-Americans and basically did not like have anything to do with them and were very much like the last Native Americans to surrender. But what happened was one of the other bands of Comanches came in riding over the hills to like protect their brethren or to fight back. And this was like at this point they had heard of the like just by the women and children who got away, just how vicious and like taken by surprise their village was. So this Comanche band comes riding over the hills and they're dressed in full war regalia. And like they were going to have like ritual combat against mainly the Tonkawas.
Okay.
Because this is like vengeance at this point. They just killed a huge number of Comanches.
So they didn't come right away when the women and children sounded the alarm.
This was kind of a long battle. This was like a three-parter battle. Okay. So first you had they killed the first few, like four or five or whatever Comanches early on. Mm-hmm. And then a couple got away and led the Rangers to the village. Okay. They had that big slaughter where Iron Jacket died. This is the third part, the third and final part of this battle that happens later on. But they show up. And they, like, are goading the Tonkawas to come out and fight them in single, like, one-on-one combat.
Oh, wow.
And the Rangers are just kind of, like, Ford says that there's a good half hour where the Rangers are just standing there like, shit, what do we do?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It is just unbelievable. And Ford wrote later
on about
this.
They basically started all this.
Yeah.
They're the Rangers are the driving force behind all these battles. And I mean, it sounds like essentially using the Tonkawa as a shield because they know that they already have this, there's already this animosity between them and the Comanches.
Right. So this is what Ford writes about this moment later on. It reminded me of one of the rude and chivalrous days of knight errantry. Shields and lances and bows and headdresses, prancing steeds and many minutiae were not wanting to compile the resemblance. And when the combatants rushed at each other with defiant shouts, nothing save the piercing report of the rifle varied the affair from a battle of the Middle Ages. Half an hour was spent in this without much damage to either party.
Well, this is exactly what I was saying before with Iron Jacket's outfit, is that to the white people, I mean, that's the first historical precedent they're going to go to. This is almost like going back in time and seeing a battle from the Middle Ages, not just because, you know, the Comanches don't have as advanced technology as they do, but because, you know, Iron Jacket's literally wearing a medieval or Renaissance era armor. And then now even like you said, the kind of the nature of the battle reflects that time of sort of one-on-one combat and there being a sort of code to warfare.
And apparently, I guess it sounds, at least from his point of view, that it was kind of mostly for show, but the Rangers did eventually charge and the Comanche line broke, again, because the Rangers just have much more powerful weapons at this point. And they finally learned how to do battle while mounted on horses.
Okay.
So they're finally becoming like a kind of a match for the Comanches. So the Comanche line breaks and the Rangers go chasing after him, but really there were few casualties on either side. So that third battle was kind of a draw, but at the end of the day the Comanches lost way more casualties than the Rangers. And so that battle was the big turning point that it became really famous because it showed, first of all, it showed the incompetence of the federal government and their ability to enforce any of these laws. Because again, this is basically on Indian reservation territory in Oklahoma. This is supposed to be like the one safe place for Native Americans. And these Texas Rangers just ride in
use
and
one tribe
slaughter
against another and also themselves slaughter. Yeah.
Right. So it shows just the total incompetence of the federal government. It makes Ford famous and kind of it's another success for the Rangers, who didn't have very many successes in their times during this area, because the Comanches were just too strong.
I mean, who did
too powerful
I'm wondering
them.
Who like making the federal government look incompetent, who would have thought that, and who would it have mattered to? I mean, maybe like people
Texans.
On the, okay.
People who lived on that frontier, people who were expecting protection from the American government. I mean, there was a point where, like, during some of the worst Comanche raids, the U.S. sent their troops up to, like, Utah to quell a Mormon revolt. And so they pulled U.S. troops out of this area to go to Utah. And this happened right before, you know, all these horrific Comanche raids happened. Mm. So there was, Texans were, like, not big fans of the federal government at this point. They partly, the reason they annexed with the U.S. was because the Republic of Texas was first of all just failing miserably and had like a currency that meant nothing. So the political implications, you know, of this battle were not good for the Comanches, because it basically convinced the troops and the federal army to abandon these passive defensive policies, and chasing the Comanches down on their own land, having these offensives, just going in and killing everyone, became much more of the norm and finally became accepted after years of like, oh, we don't want to exterminate, we just want treaties, but we don't have any like sense of how to go about doing that.
Yeah.
So it was really sad for the Comanches that the Rangers like took this on. And the thing that really was the downfall for the Comanche Nation, though, was the slaughter of like all the buffalo, because that happened maybe like 5 or 10 years after this battle, the Battle of Antelope Hills, is that white settlers finally realized that, oh, the way we can take them down is by just killing all the buffalo that they need to survive. And it was like almost an extermination of the buffalo. I mean, within maybe like 20 years, 15 years, they killed probably 31 million buffalo.
I didn't realize that there was a strategic purpose to it. Because the image I always have in my head is of people taking the train west and shooting buffalo out of the train. I always thought there was like a, there was just sort of carelessness.
Always read that there was just an overpopulation of buffalo. And so that white settlers wouldn't be able to like settle the land without killing all this buffalo. But in reading my research this past week, it was like strategically another way of
to take away resources from
take
the
away
Comanche.
Resources from the Comanches and other Native American tribes. Wow. So very sad way to end. I wish I had a better ending to that story.
I feel like I knew the general outline of this period of history, but there was a lot of stuff in your telling of that story that was really new and powerful, and I will now forever have the image of Iron Jack in a Spanish conquistador's armor that had been passed down, you know, through generations, and then that armor not being enough to withstand this new technology, new bigger, you know, faster guns. I don't know. Yeah, there's just a lot there that will stick with me.
It's a really fascinating story, and again, like it just goes to show this. Like, American history is so tragic and fascinating. And it's something that I wish, at 28 years old, I wish I knew more. Yeah. Like, I feel like, oh my God, I know nothing about, like, the history of my own country. Like, all I know is, like, honestly, propaganda.
Yeah.
I don't mean to be one of those, like, ooh, propaganda, everything's propaganda.
No, but I mean,
like,
propaganda
it's
just a very basic level where you just like you can't tell. Like I think there's just, it's just natural because history is so full of these stories and these atrocities and these things, unethical things that your ancestors have done. You can't tell people that because you won't have a country. You won't have a coherent,
so.
You won't have a cohesive country. I
How different do you think we would be if, as children, we were told like this version? Like if, like being, me being from Texas, I took Texas history in elementary school and middle school. Like if they had told this version of Texas history, like how different would my mentality be?
And I should say, sorry, what I mean is like, I'm saying that from the perspective of someone who thinks of a country as being mine, or being, you know, you no longer will have your country if you tell the truth about what you.
Right. You run the risk of losing like patriotism or support in the government or in the culture. Yeah. But it's funny because it kind of feels like it's happening anyways.
Well, yeah. And I mean, and that's what I think you see in American culture now is this tide of just entitlement and ownership meeting. It's getting to a point of absurdity where it's just so, I think the tide of emotion that resulted in Trump being elected is so at odds with history, is so at odds with the course of history, and is so backwards. But it's because it gets to a desperate point where in order to, all you want to do is maintain your power and entitlement. In order to do that, you have to lie about history, you have to deny things that have happened in the past, and you have to tell a much better story about yourself and a much worse story about other people in order to, you know, maintain loyalty and cohesiveness among your people. I think that.
Well, and the other thing that this book really doesn't mention that you and I talked about briefly the other day is like, while all this is happening, like African Americans or Africans are being enslaved on the East Coast, and white settlers are moving into Texas and this whole area with their slaves.
Right.
And that is being carried out at the same time that the Native Americans are essentially being first being, you know, doing these wars and then eventually just being exterminated and sent down like the Trail of Tears to land that's supposed to be safe for them, but really is just another place where they get killed and murdered by white men.
Right. I mean, Texas is brought into the Union as a slave state. So,
and I guess as a kid, it's like, how can you learn about those histories and be very patriotic at all? But I think there's a way to like tell these histories and be honest about it without being like super anti-American. I think there's got to be a way where teachers could do it. It's not impossible.
Or you can just pave the way towards those revelations, I think, by in earlier stages of education, just telling multiple stories.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Telling the truth.
Yeah.
Like I had one elementary school teacher who told me like Vietnam War was a tie because she didn't want to have to admit that like America lost a war. Her big argument was like America's never lost a war. And like one like super smart little boy in our class was like, what about the Vietnam War? I don't know how he knew about it. I guess he was just like a well-read kid.
Yeah,
but she was like, well, that one was a tie. And that's what I thought until I got to, I don't know. At some point, I learned about the Vietnam War again and was like, oh, no, we fucked that up.
Which honestly is the most damning admission that was a disaster. If that person says it's a tie, the person who is going to take the.
But that was like the history. It was like, if it's not pro white American, like pro English settlers, then we're not going to know about it.
Well, I was going to say, and I don't know if this is the best idea, it's just off the top of my head, but I was going to say, you know, maybe one way, because it is hard to, you know, to tell little kids about like atrocities and these things, but I think one way is to
details.
Well, I think one way is to just tell positive stories about people from other races. So
true.
Just like, you know, like, so you and tell stories from other points of view. So you pave the way towards these later revelations when they are old enough to kind of comprehend it by just teaching a
positive stories about
an education that is just naturally multicultural and naturally has multiple points of view to it, and so that when you get to the point where you can actually tell the realities of history, they aren't already programmed to think of white Americans as inherently
you don't
superior
have that, like,
to any
bizarre
other group.
Entitlement or like psychology.
So it's easier to accept those things as opposed to, you know, it being this, you know, this huge shock. And I mean, it probably should, there should be some point in your life where you are shocked by history and continually shocked by history. I think that's a good experience, but you want that shock to be relative to what you're mentally able to comprehend.
You don't
want to
have to do a total 180.
Yeah. Yes.
Mentally.
Yeah.
To come to terms with it.
Well, so we ended with some really great thoughts about how to improve education.
Whoever's listening.
Yeah. I mean, nobody's listening right now that is in any position of power in the
President Trump,
Department of Education.
If you're listening, yeah. I mean, feel free to take any of this and roll with it.
I mean,
it.
He is a great...
Betsy DeVos.
Yeah.
Feel free. These ideas are open.
I mean, Trump does consume a lot of media, so maybe we're on his list.
We get a tweet later. Sad! Exclamation point.
Hates America.
Amy Holt and Brett Boehm hate America. Sad.
All right. Well, with that.
So with that, we can say Here Lies, Iron Jacket, and 75 other Comanche lives, and the Battle of Antelope Hills.
Which occurred calendar date yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get back in our time machine.
Yep.
And fly away.
We used to sit and tell of our love in the pines where the sun never shines. But now she's gone like the turtle dove in the pines, in the pines, in the pines.
Forever! Dog!
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.